everybody. Welcome to the Science Podcast with Bunsen Burner. This is episode 3 of season 1. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher and the dog dad of Bunsen Burner, the Twitter science dog. You can follow Bunsen on Twitter at BunsenBurnerBMD. He's on Instagram and Facebook at BunsenBurner.BMD. You can also find him on TikTok with a similar handle. We also have an adorable merchandise shop, which has a whole bunch of science gear and science puns with cartoons of Bunsen on it. The link to Bunsen merch is in the description of the podcast, also on his social media handles. The podcast with Bunsen Burner will always be free, but if you'd like to support the show, we have a Patreon set up at patreon.com/BunsenBurner. There's some really cool swag that you can get depending on the tier that you sign up with. Head over there to check it out if you'd like. The top tier actually will net you an adorable stuffed animal of Bunsen that we're developing. We have such a fun show lined up for you guys today. We have some science news, science facts, a great interview with Dr. Heather Cowie, who is an optometrist, and we'll open up the mailbag and answer questions from some people. So we might as well get on with it, because there's no time like science time. Today in Science News, we're going to take a look at the moon and how it affects animal behavior. Researchers have been looking at how moonlight affects animals for decades. And there are a couple animals that have some very unique interactions with the moon. The study took a look at lions in Tanzania and looked at their hunting patterns depending on how much moonlight there was. On nights with a lot of moonlight, the lions were more likely to be out hunting, looking for prey in the more brightly lit surroundings. If it was pitch black, they still were out stalking their prey, just not as much as in the moonlit night. The animals that are preyed on by the lions tend to move around much less on moonlit nights. Probably there's some kind of evolutionary benefit not to be out poking around and chewing on grass when the lions can see you a little bit better. So the interaction between prey and predator is dependent on light at night, and that's dependent on how much the moon is shining. One really interesting organism that uses moonlight is the dung beetle. If they've buried something of importance, dung, gross, but maybe not to dogs, they'll use polarized moonlight. So lunar light that comes from the sky gets bounced around off of molecules of gas in the air, in the atmosphere. And that means the light waves, when they're polarized, kind of vibrate in the same plane. This produces a pattern that, you know, our eyes can't see, but dung beetles can. And they actually use that to determine where their buried important item is. Scientists have actually tested this by shining polarized light at dung beetles to determine that they actually can see the pattern. Otherwise, you can't really interview a dung beetle. You know, they're not really that talkative. Zooplankton in the ocean get out of Dodge when the moon is shining bright. They swim down below, down in the depths of the ocean, as deep as they can go, to get out of the light. And that's where they get hunted by organisms that might feed on them. It's a common misconception that some animals use the moon as a method of communication. Wolves, ancestors to dogs, are always depicted as howling at the moon. It's true that wolves do howl. Bunsen doesn't, he just barks, but there are some other dog breeds that kind of yodel or howl. The biggest reason why people think that wolves and the moon maybe go together is just historical context. Perhaps it was just easier to see the wolves at night howling when the moon was shining bright. Sometimes when you don't have light pollution coming from other directions, the moon actually produces a significant amount of light on its own. Farmers called this the harvest moon, and they would use it to get crops off the field when, you know, they were behind on the harvest. Wolves don't howl at night more when there's a moon present than when there's not a moon present. So all of this research is fascinating. It all ties together with how organisms use moonlight to move around. We live in the country outside of a major city, so we don't have a lot of light pollution at night. When the moon is shining bright, like a full moon, if Bunsen has to go out before we go to bed to do his business, I don't need to take a flashlight. The moon produces enough light for me to easily see where we're going, which is just super cool. And that's the science news of the week. On to science.
Moon or wow.
In this section, I'll be giving you three statements, Two of them will be fake. They will be woo. And one of them will be real. It will be wow. It's amazing you didn't know that. Here we go. Here's the first statement. Toilet flushes spin a different direction in the southern hemisphere. Or if you're in the southern hemisphere, they spin a different direction in the northern hemisphere. Here's the second statement. The largest living organisms are the blue whale and the redwood trees or the redwood forest. Bunsen likes trees. Don't you, Bunsen? And the third statement. There are more bacteria cells in your body than your normal human cells. What do you think? Let's recap. Statement one, water spins a different direction depending on the hemisphere that you are located in. Statement two, the largest living organism in the world is the blue whale or the redwood forest. And statement three, the bacteria in your body outnumber your body cells. Think about it. Okay, time's up. Let's start with the first one that's woo. So the largest organism in the world, being the blue whale or the redwood forest, is that true? And the answer is no. No. The largest organism in the world is something called the honey fungus found in Oregon. It can spread to be about 4 kilometers squared. And they're spreading everywhere. The good thing is that the honey mushroom or the honey fungus is edible. So I guess as it spreads, we can just eat it back. Do you like mushrooms, Bunsen? So that leaves us the spinning water and the number of bacteria in your body compared to regular body cells. Okay, so the one that's woo will give away the one that isn't. And the one that's woo is the spinning water one. So there was a big myth that depending on where you were in the world, the water, especially when you flushed a toilet, would spin a different direction. It's called the Coriolis effect, but, and yes, that's true. Flow patterns are affected by the Earth's rotation. That helps explain a lot of, you know, climate systems or weather systems. But when you flush a toilet, it's actually the design feature of the toilet or the design feature of like the sink that you're having water drain out of. I remember a really funny Simpsons episode where the Simpsons went to Australia and they were in the U.S. Embassy. And when Homer went to flush the toilet, there's a special machine that reversed it back the way that people were used to it in Springfield. And that was just a bunch of hooey. So that's woo. So that means, as hard as it is to believe, that the bacteria one is true. There are more bacteria in your body than human cells. A lot of those bacteria do amazing things for our body. Our gut bacteria is really important for maintaining immunity. A lot of the bacteria in our body helps us digest food. And a lot of the bacteria is just around us all the time, and it does outnumber our body cells. In fact, a lot of studies show there's 9 to 10 times more bacteria cells in your body than human cells. And that's kind of gross. I wonder if there's more bacteria in a dog's mouth than a human's mouth. We should leave that one another day. And now you know a little bit more science trivia. Now the section called
Woo or Wow
is complete. On the show today, we're going to be interviewing Dr. Heather Cowie. She's an optometrist who works in Alberta. She doles out great information in the segment. Also, some warnings and some suggestions for parents regarding children's health. Let's get right to the Ask the Experts section and talk about eyeballs. Hi, we've got Dr. Heather Cowie today on Ask an Expert. Hi, Dr. Cowie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I'm so glad we're going to be talking about eyeballs today.
This is so exciting.
I'm glad you think so.
Great.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I'm excited that you agreed to do the podcast so quickly. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. I listened to your first one, and I was like, you bet.
How long have you been an optometrist?
Oh, gosh. I am coming up on 10 years.
So the first question we ask on the Ask an Expert part of the podcast is, just tell me a little bit about your science background, your training to be an optometrist.
Yeah, for sure. So after high school, I went and I knew I wanted to be in healthcare. So I did a Bachelor's of Science degree from the University of Calgary. And in between my studies, I actually took a little bit of time off and I did some volunteering and some traveling in Central America. And that's why I was asked to be a translator for an eye care team. And so I did that and I was absolutely hooked about optometry and eye care. And so I came back to Canada and I finished my Doctor of Optometry degree from the University of Waterloo. And then during my time as a student, and then also once I graduated as an optometrist, I did a number of short-term international eye care missions, and those really propelled me to go back to school and get a master's degree in public health. And I'm really excited because I just finished that about 2 months ago from the Johns Hopkins University.
Oh, wow. How are you a translator? Like, do you speak more than just English?
Yeah, so I was so lucky. I was in the French immersion program growing up. And so I had French kind of under my belt. And so I actually just wanted to try to learn Spanish. And after being in Central America for a couple of months, I had a pretty solid grasp on it. So I was able to translate for volunteers from the U.S. and Canada into Spanish.
You know, I hear that from... I hear that from high school kids that once you know French or once you know Spanish, learning the third language goes way quicker because there's some similarities. Not tons, but there's some.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and you can make really good guesses. You just add O's and A's and see what happens.
That's funny. You are multidisciplinary.
I try.
So as an optometrist, what do you like best about your job?
Oh gosh, I love my job. Truly, I am absolutely passionate about being an optometrist. I love that I have such variety. So I get to care for patients from babies to seniors and everyone in between. I get to help children with red eyes and pink eyes. I get to work with first glasses. I get to work with contact lenses. I get to work with injuries. I can do emergency medicine where somebody's got metal in the eye and we can help out with that. Yeah, it's a really fun one. And it happens more often than you think it would. But and it's great. I get to work with, you know, sort of acute medicine. I can work with chronic medicine. I have patients with diabetes, with glaucoma, with macular degeneration. And it's just this huge, wonderful variety of people that I get to work with, which is it's so exciting in itself. But also in medicine, I can really be challenged in a number of different areas, which is exciting. And it's kind of funny because I sort of think, what I like most about my career is the variety. Because when I was first thinking about optometry, I was really worried I was going to be bored.
Oh, yeah.
I was really worried that I was going to be, that I was like, I'm going to be in this dark room saying one or two.
And really? That's not what you guys do? You don't go, one or two, and then you get bamboozled, and you're like, well, I think two is better, but was it one? And then...
that's exactly it. So it gets like more exciting than that. So, I love that. I love that not only I can do optometry and medicine, but I can run a business, and I can be a part of creating a clinic culture that I'm proud of, and... Now with this master's, I can now further expand and I can really do some international work.
I had a question about pink eye, but we might have to save that for, you know, a second podcast. And the other thing, eye safety, probably, you know, with the stuff that gets in people's eyes.
You bet.
Yeah. Bunsen, of course, always wears his safety goggles when he's in the lab.
Of course. I'm glad to hear that.
And speaking of Bunsen, he's our dog. This being a dog and science podcast together, do you have any pets? Do you have a dog? Do you have a memorable dog story you could share with people?
I love that I'm a part of this because I'm actually quite allergic to a lot of animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I married a man that's even more allergic, so we really like admire from afar. But I was lucky enough to dog sit our neighbor's dog while we were growing up. And her name was Brandy, and I loved her to pieces. And she, I can't tell you what type of dog she was, other than she was small and fluffy and amazing. And she loved catching the balls. Like, she would just whip down and catch anything we threw for her. And what was so cool is that she only had three legs. And she could pretty much beat any of the other neighborhood dogs. It was just so neat, I think, as when I was a child, to see this and recognize that it was mostly the humans that cared that she was missing a leg, more so than she did. She didn't really bother her at all, and I thought that was just really cool to see that resilience in another animal. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's the thing. Dogs don't know, at least I don't know if they know, that they have less legs than other dogs. I think they just get on with things, and they live in the moment.
So true, yeah.
You know, that's the thing. People always ask why Bunsen isn't in my school. Like, I bring him in during exam times, and he's really good for some of the kids that have exam anxiety. They come and he's good with them, and they cuddle with him, and they give him belly rubs. But one of the things I have to tell people is that one of the reasons why he can't come in my class all the time is there's people with legit allergies to the dander and the hair that comes off of animals, and that's one of the reasons why therapy dogs just aren't ubiquitous in every classroom, is there are people with medical reasons why the dogs can't be there.
That's right.
So the fourth question is, what's one thing that people should know about eye health? What's something you could share with people? And it may not be just one thing. If you can't narrow it down, what are some things about eye health people don't necessarily think about, or they should think about?
Yeah, for sure. So one of the things that I focused on with my master's, and something I'm really passionate about, is children and their eyes. And there is a little bit of a misconception out there that parents or guardians would know if their child was having a vision issue. And that's simply not true. The vast majority of vision issues that affect children, you wouldn't be able to tell as a parent or as a loved one or as a family member around them. It is absolutely imperative that they get their eyes checked by an optometrist, because unless it's really severe, there rarely is symptoms. And kids, I find, they're resilient. They just squint, or they just look at their friend's notebook, or they just don't see it. And they don't tend to complain about it. And so they're a population that is vulnerable, because when it comes to learning and development and reading, it's really hard to do that well if you don't see clearly.
Oh my goodness.
That's huge. And it's just so interesting, because where I practice in Alberta Healthcare covers exams for children until they turn 19. And we even have a program for kindergarten kids to get free prescription glasses.
Awesome.
It's amazing. But despite these programs, we have less than half of the kids in kindergarten seeing an eye doctor.
Oh, it's that low? That's shocking.
It's that low. It's really shocking. Yeah, it's the 42%. So
42? You know, that's less than
42%.
50. Wow.
Yeah, and that's actually the highest it's been in a few years.
Oh my goodness.
You know, yeah, when we talk about setting up our kids for success and, you know, sort of the back to school checklist, it's somehow just not getting on there.
Oh, that's so important.
It has to be. So that's one of my big things, is that you don't know how somebody else is seeing. It's hard for you to predict how somebody else is doing, and so you just need to get them checked. And especially kids, but even seniors. My gosh, even seniors and such, any vulnerable population, they need to come in. When they can't always advocate for themselves. That would be my number one big take home message.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm just thinking that our kindergarten and grade one teachers, maybe they catch it, but how much of the year has gone by where a kid has just struggled with the building blocks of education, you know, reading, writing, and basic math, and they just, Maybe
exactly.
Maybe they just literally could not see what was happening.
That's yeah, all. And it's so exactly, and it's so, and sometimes with vision, we sometimes just think about acuity. You know, how well can I see at a distance? You know, the eye chart. How well can I see the eye chart? But it's so much more than that. I've had kids in my practice that they have 20/20 vision. They can see a mile away, but when they read, they get the words move on the page, or the words split and they're seeing double. There's other aspects to vision that we need to check and make sure that these kids are doing okay. Because we can get missed year and year and year after year, or we start to sort of question it once kids struggle and fall behind in school, which is never a good thing. And so this is, I think, a really easy thing that we can do a better job at.
You betcha. That's going to be the tagline for this podcast. Get your kids' eyes checked.
Love it. That'd be great. That, you know, the other thing that I see all the time is we can do so much with preventative medicine now. Mm-hmm. We don't have to wait for somebody to come in that says, I've lost vision. I'm struggling to see this. We have so much technology now that we can look for risk factors for glaucoma, for macular degeneration before somebody is symptomatic. Before somebody says, I think there's something wrong with my vision,
right.
Which is a far better approach to managing care and saving vision, because it's precious. Our vision is precious.
You betcha.
And we've got to then line up our priorities of taking care of it.
Yeah. Our grandfather, he has glaucoma from diabetes, and he's lost his vision over time, and we've seen the frustrations firsthand. You know, we people who are sighted take that for granted until it's taken away from you, and then that's your whole world is your vision.
Yeah, you know, I can't remember where I read this quote or I saw this quote that I believe that vision is kind of like air. We don't really think about it until we're scared of losing it, and then that's the only thing we think about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great quote. Love that. What would you tell somebody that they'd go, "Wow, I had no idea that was that was a thing."
Well, yeah. Well, one thing, this is actually quite new kind of on the horizon of when we're looking at global eye care, is that we are seeing a massive increase globally of myopia.
Okay.
So we've never had this many kids and people on the planet that need nearsighted correction for glasses. And not only are we seeing this many, but we're actually seeing kids especially need glasses at a younger age and at a faster progression.
Are there any theories as to why that is? Like, I could speculate from the tech being so close to our eyes.
Bingo.
That is
the biggest hypothesis right now, is that it is our devices. That we have never before had this much sort of eyeballs to screens at such a close proximity to our face before. And that I'm hesitant to say that we know for sure that this is the cause, but pretty much every eye doctor thinks that's what's happening with pretty high confidence, because we are really just not built to be looking 30, 40 centimeters from our face for hours on end.
No, that's fascinating. I brought that up with my students in one of my classes, that, you know, human beings evolved to recognize patterns, but also to see long distances, right? Being able to see close up wasn't a skill set that we needed for survival as much as being able to see far away. So now your ability to see close up is what you do all the time. Does kids just get lazy? Like, do they just not develop the muscles to see further away? Or do those atrophy?
No.
Like, there's got to be some kind of physiology there, right?
Exactly. You know, and I think it really just comes to, what is the stimulus? And if the stimulus is saying, you need to be seeing clearly on your little phone right in front of your face, well, that's nearsightedness. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And that our visual system's amazing. It is adaptable. It changes, it modifies, and certainly it would respond to stimulus that we are creating in our environment. Now I should probably do a research project on that to test that, but you know, it certainly is something that we're seeing now. And I'm I'm positive that in the next few years, we're going to have some really good, solid data saying this is the effect that we're seeing now.
Right. Yeah. The research has to come out before that's the conclusion of
that's
the scientific
right.
body.
That's right. There is really important to have quality data and quality research. Before we have headlines, certainly. But there's a ton of research going on to it now. And a lot of research too going into how can we slow this down? How can we make a dent? Which is really fascinating. And then one of the newest products that we just brought in are Enchroma glasses. And those are the glasses for patients with color vision deficiencies.
I have heard of these.
Oh, man. There's something. It will never get old watching somebody put on a pair of glasses and watching them see something they've never seen before. It is just fantastic.
Okay, so these glasses are legit because I've read conflicting reports that sometimes it's maybe a little bit of pseudoscience, but they're
well,
legit.
Yeah, so it doesn't work for everybody.
Okay.
And unfortunately, what has happened with, of course, social media is that the 20% of people who it works amazingly for and they have sort of a visceral, you know, emotional reaction, those are what all the videos get posted,
right?
And so there certainly are some of that wow, immediate, amazing, holy smokes thing. Now, all of these patients that put them on, they still see color vision.
Yeah.
So it's not like they go black and white to color. It's not quite that dramatic, which some headlines are claiming.
Yeah.
But certainly, and even some of my team that works with me who have color vision deficiencies, there is a palatable difference in what they see once they get used to these glasses. Now, again, it's not everybody. It's not 100% of people because there's different severities and stuff as well. And one thing that we always have to remember is that we don't see with our eyes. We see with our brain.
Right.
Right. We see with the visual processing in our brain. And so we can do whatever we want to light coming into a person's eye. And that's what essentially these glasses are doing. They're filtering light.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's not processed differently to say, oh, hey, I can now see the red in this color. This is purple and not blue. That sort of processing is what we're relying on for a person to actually perceive a difference. And so there's a little bit of a let's see if you're going to detect the difference.
Oh, cool!
If we just change the light. So yeah. So it's certainly really really neat. There, it doesn't make these patients sort of color vision normal, but they will certainly experience things if it works that they've never witnessed before.
Yeah,
which is exciting.
I can see why that would be such a rewarding, you know, give them the glasses and their world kind of changes for them.
Yeah, it's great to be the bystander. It's just great.
Ah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, this brings us to a close of the Ask an Expert part of the podcast.
Great.
Heather, thanks so much for agreeing to do this.
For sure. Thank you. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
No problem.
All right, guys, I just opened the mailbag, and it's time for the mailbag with Adam.
You might hear some rattling in the mailbag section because Bunsen has a bone thing that he's playing with, but I think it gives authenticity so you can hear him move around rather than being silent for the rest of the other parts of the podcast.
All right, so the first question comes from I'll Procrastinate Tomorrow on Twitter. About you, how did your mom and dad come across you? That is, where did you come to them from? Parentheses, rescue plug. What was your first day home like? About your family, does your human brother get jealous of your popularity?
Okay, well, we'll start where Bunsen came from. He came from a little community just outside of Edmonton, which is about an hour and a half north of us. He came from a Swiss family, and they had only one male and one female that had a litter of pups. So it wasn't a very big operation, and that's what we liked right away is just how cared for and kind the family was to the two parents. And how did we pick Bunsen?
Well, originally when we were looking at the Bernese Mountain Dog breed, we were going to get a female. And so when we initially went up to meet the family, we only had eyes on the female pups. And then after meeting several different breeders, we noticed that the females tended to be a little bit more standoffish. And that's not what we wanted in a dog. So we went up, and now with our sights on a male, and we went in, and Bunsen was the first one to come see us. He came loping over, and he was interested in us and spent some time with us. And that's the type of dog that we were interested in.
Yeah.
So that's how we picked him.
Do you remember how chubby he was, Adam?
He looked like a brick. He looked like a banana mixed with a brick mixed with a dog.
He was so cute. And I didn't even look at his markings. I think, Chris, you noticed that his markings were super striking. But I wanted him as soon as he came over just for his personality when we picked him out. But it wasn't until later that I noticed just how striking his paws are. Like, his paws are just unbelievably cute. We just love his paws to death. And Adam, do you get jealous of Bunsen or do you care?
I don't really care that much. I just feel like as long as it's someone who's popular in the family, we'll all be good. And yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely more popular than any of us. I think you get some street cred with your friends, though, don't you?
He does. A lot of my friends know Bunsen. They're like, how is he so popular? He's just so cute.
There we go.
All right, so the next question comes from Andrea Humphrey. She says, what has been the toughest skill, aka trick, to learn since you were a pup?
Well, I'm going to butt in with this one. We had him doing cleanup, and he was working really, really well at home.
What is cleanup, Chris?
Well, when you say, get it, fetch it, and they bring it over and they put it into a basket or a bin. So take it, bring it, and he was doing it with garbage at home. So things like a ripped off paper towel or an empty toilet paper tube. And part of his level three test was that he needed to complete this three times successfully. And there were toys there, and we're thinking, oh, this is going to be no problem, because at home, initially he started with the toilet tubes, but then moved on to toys quite effectively.
Yeah, he was so good at it from home. Chris would say, who made this big mess? And then Bunsen would clean up all of his junk.
But that was not what happened when we were there testing, and he almost didn't pass his level three because he wasn't doing it. So I said, well, how about we try with this garbage, like this toilet paper tube.
I think you asked, do you have any garbage for Bunsen to use?
Yeah, and then she did, and so then he did it. But it was nip and tuck there. I was a little worried.
What about you, Adam? Is there any skill that Bunsen struggles with you?
Yeah, I feel like the take it and leave it was the hardest trick for him, just because, like, I also helped a bit with the take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't really respond to me just because I wasn't with them there to do it. But yeah, he's been good at like basically everything else.
The one skill with me that he struggled with and I had to train with him over and over and over again was a silent come and then a down with a silent down command. So the dog comes to you without any verbal commands. They have to look at you or your physical motions. And then with a down motion or a dropped motion, they have to flatten immediately on the ground. And for some reason, Bunsen just really struggled with that. And it took a bunch of practice, and he's really good at it now. It's super cute. Like, you get him to come to you, and you just kind of, and he just flattens on the ground like a pancake. Yeah, but that was really tough.
So the last question from Edward Gullion is, do burners, or doggies for that matter, tend to gravitate towards babies/toddlers? And do they sense when someone in the family is going through some physical or mental illness?
What do you think? We have you have a cousin, Ellie.
Yeah.
How old is Ellie?
She's 5, and Bunsen absolutely loves her. And we have babies in our family, and he loves them a lot.
Yeah. My brother's little guy is a little quick guy named Xavier. Yeah, Bunsen likes Xavier. And you know, I don't have to worry that Bunsen's going to hurt the little kids by accident, for sure, because he's so big. Like, if they're hugging him and then Bunsen, like, gets up, he can, like, hip check them across the room. So you got to watch that with big dogs. What about the physical pain or mental thing?
So Jason might not realize this, but he was pretty much incapacitated with a migraine the other day. And Bunsen knew right away, and he was laying by his side, and it was, you could really tell that he was there for to comfort you.
I don't remember that because my headache was so bad.
And for the another physical illness that I went through was when I was in my marching band, I tore a muscle in my leg, and it hurt really bad. And Bunsen was like walking around to make sure I didn't fall or anything.
Definitely at our, when I bring him into my school during that exam time when there's a heightened amount of stress. I don't know if Bunsen can sense that, but he senses the kids really need comfort from him. And as long as he's not like exhausted or has to go to the bathroom, he's super friendly with them and lopes over and gives them hugs and belly rubs. And he picks a couple kids that he gloms onto, and they just love that. They love that they have this giant protector dog that follows them around when they're, you know, taking a break from studying. Oh, is Bunsen getting a rub from Adam?
Yep, Bunsen's getting a rub. He's under the table.
Okay, well, that's the end of the mailbag. Thanks so much for tuning in to episode 3. We have so many more exciting guests coming up in the future week, and we're so thankful that Dr. Heather Cowie agreed to come on the podcast and share her knowledge with us. There's no time like science time, and we're going to end with Bunsen's motto: for science, for empathy, and cuteness. Until next week, science rocks!